The death of the 15-year-old who died after the car in which he was travelling hit a tree in Clondalkin in Dublin provides the lead story in today's Irish Daily Star, Irish Daily Mirror and Herald. Four of the boy's friends, aged between 14 and 16, who all live near Cherry Orchard in Ballyfermot, who were also travelling in the car with him, also sustained serious injuries in the crash. Differences among medical staff led to legal move. That's the lead story in today's Irish Times, where we're told that surgeons who treated the pregnant woman at the centre of the current High Court proceedings recommended her life support be switched off after determining that she was clinically dead. But lawyers for the HSE became involved when another member of the medical team treating the woman expressed concern about possible legal issues arising out of the case. The case is before the High Court tomorrow, when the woman's father is expected to ask for her to be made a ward of court. The family have been seeking to have her life support switched off, but the HSE, acting on legal advice, is keeping her alive. The father of the woman's unborn child is also understood to be in favour of switching off her life support, although he is not party to tomorrow's proceedings. The Irish Independent leads this morning with the line that Sean Quinn is to be employed as an advisor to his former company, which was bought out by what the paper describes as a group of local business leaders in the border region. 1,100 people on brink of losing homes, that's the lead headline in the Irish Examiner. The Irish Sun has a lead story today about a 46-year-old Pakistani national who says that she was trafficked into Ireland and treated as a slave for 2 years by two Irish-based Pakistani doctors. Sultana Anwar, who was forced to work 18 hours a day, minding the couple's three children in their home in Leinster and also cleaning their rental properties, managed to escape when a neighbour put her in contact with the Migrant Rights Centre, who have since called in the Gardaí to review the case. Anti-booze pill for alcoholics. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Daily Mail, which reports that a drug called Selincro, which curbs the craving for alcohol experienced by heavy drinkers, has been approved for use and will be available to those on a medical card and through the drugs payment scheme. Elsewhere on the front pages, both The Times and Independent report that US billionaire John Malone, who is behind UPC-owned Liberty Global, has bought Sir Anthony O'Reilly's Castlemartin estate for close to €28 million. Both papers also carry front page stories on that Higher Education Authority report, which finds that the proportion of Irish college graduates emigrating has doubled from 5% to 12% since 2009. Both papers use the term brain drain in their reports, and The Independent devotes its lead editorial to this story and to an open letter which Tara Monaghan from Salins, County Kildare, has written to the Taoiseach, also carried in today's paper. The 24-year-old schoolteacher who emigrated to London in 2012 writes, "I'm coming home for Christmas, but I want to come home for good. I want to contribute to the society I was raised in, to give back, to belong. I do not feel entitled to the life I hope for, but I am entitled to the chance to work for it." But finally, staying with the theme of emigrants returning, The Independent is a story today about a hurling match which is to be played in Tipperary over Christmas. 17 players who were on the Gertnahoe Glengool team, which made it to the county intermediate finals in 2009 and 2010, have now scattered around the globe, and they plan to take on the current team on St Stephen's Day in the Home to Hurl 2014 challenge.
Thanks, Gavin. Employers group IBEX says that despite disappointing preliminary growth figures for the third 3 months of the year, the Irish economy will outperform the rest of Europe and grow by 5.7% this year. In its latest quarterly economic outlook, says the recovery finally reached the domestic economy, with unemployment falling, investment increasing, and the Irish consumer looking ahead with more confidence. IBEX, though, highlights some risks and opportunities on the horizon for 2015. It says lower oil prices will add extra momentum to the consumer recovery, with every $10 fall in the price of a barrel of oil translating into an additional 100 million spending power for Irish consumers. IBEX forecasts continuing strong growth in 2015, and we'll have more on this when we're joined by IBEX chief economist Fergal O'Brien at 10 to 8. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have blamed the oil price fall on producers outside OPEC and reaffirmed their stance to keep output at current levels. Saudi Arabia's oil minister said he was 100% not pleased with the near 50% slide in crude oil prices since the middle of June, but said it was a lack of non-OPEC cooperation that was the key contributor to the sharp decline. Speaking at the same gathering, the United Arab Emirates energy minister said one of the principal reasons for the price falls was the irresponsible production of some producers from outside OPEC. Global energy forecasters are expecting less demand for OPEC OPEC oil in 2015 amid a rise in US shale production and a slowdown in demand in Europe and Asia. And average wholesale gas prices for December are down 25% compared to the same time last year. That's according to Veu's latest wholesale energy market report, and it's because of consistently weak demand, strong supplies and a positive storage outlook. On the currency markets this morning, the euro is trading at $1.22.56 and at 78.31 pence sterling.
Well, throughout the year-long debacle over Irish water, the argument has consistently been made by the government and others that the new utility will do more to improve the country's creaking infrastructure. This year has certainly seen a massive water meter installation programme, but has there also been a rise in the number of leaks being repaired? Our reporter Colman O'Sullivan has been finding out. Colman, you have some figures. Will we start with the capital investment programme? How much has been spent?
Well, we have the figures for the first 11 months of this year, and that's just under 300 million. Now, that is a slight increase on the 275 million that the state spent last year. But state spending that year was very low by previous historical standards, and that was because the government was preparing to hand over the infrastructure to Irish Water. So its last water investment programme, which covered the years 2010 to 2012, had run out, but it didn't draw up a new programme because obviously it was waiting for the new company to come in and take over. A better comparison maybe is if you look at the average annual spend by the state over the years 2004 to 2013. That averages out at 430 million per year. So the 300 million spend this year is much lower, and it's much lower than the highest spending year of 2009, when there was 512 million invested in water infrastructure. As you said there, the raison d'etre of Irish Water was to allow proper investment in the water services and to upgrade the system, but at the moment that doesn't seem to be happening.
Now, Irish Water has commented on this. What have they said?
Well, they said that in May they announced their capital programme for this year, and they set that at 320 million. And they said they're going to spend more than that. They're going to spend 340 million by the end of year. And next year, they expect to spend 410 million. They had set out a programme of capital expenditure for the first 3 years, 2014, 15, and 16, and submitted that to the energy regulator. That was for 1.77 billion. But at the moment, the rate of spending seems to be well below that, so it's hard to see how they will achieve that. But they argue also that it's not about how much they spend, it's about what they do. So they say that if they can get things in for less money, then it doesn't matter as long as they deliver the projects. And they point to the Ringsend treatment plant, where they say they halved the original cost of 350 million and brought that down to around 170 million. On the comparison with previous years, they also argued that if you take the years 2004 to 2013, that includes some of the Celtic Tiger years when state spending was at its highest. And so obviously that level of funding is not available anymore.
Now, since the start of the year, how many leaks have actually been fixed? Are there figures for that?
We have figures for that. At the moment, the figures we have are covering the first 10 months, and that is about 22,000 leaks. That compares to 26,000 leaks repaired for the whole of last year. So if you take that there's 2 months left in this year after those figures, you add 20%, it comes to that we're going to have more or less the same number of leaks fixed this year as last year.
Is the situation consistent across the country?
No, and you need to remember that although Irish Water has taken over, what is happening is that its representatives on the ground in each area are still the local authorities, and across the local authority areas there's quite a lot of variation. Some local authorities have seen massive improvements in the numbers of leaks fixed. So if you look at the Cork County area, they fixed 2,200 leaks last year. Already by the end of October this year, it had repaired 3,100. So that's quite an increase. In Dublin City Council, the numbers are 1,600 for last year and 2,125 for the first 10 months of this year. Again, so big improvement. But then other councils have seen big drops. If you go next door from Dublin City Council into Dunleary Rathdown, it fixed 882 leaks last year, but just 175 in the first 10 months of this year. Now, it's worth noting that Dunleary had warned Irish Water when it was agreeing the service plan for this year that its leak detection team had been depleted because people who retired were not replaced. And perhaps this is a consequence of that. If you look at another Dublin local authority, Fingal, it repaired 652 leaks last year and just 371 in the first 10 months of this year. I think it is interesting to look across the four Dublin local authorities, because obviously water supply is a big issue in Dublin. Mm-hmm. We've barely enough, and if we can fix the leaks, we can improve that. The number of leaks fixed is on course to be up about 10%. And that may be related to the fact that Dublin has seen the most intensive metering programme. That might support Irish Water's argument that metering does help to find leaks. But some of the critics of the company also argue that sometimes when you install meters, you cause leaks.
You've also been looking at the situation outside Dublin. Which counties stand out there?
Well, one that stood out for me was Laois. Officials there had previously warned Irish Water that they believe more than 50% of their treated water is being lost to leaks. And the council didn't have sufficient resources to repair all of the leaks. It found 355 last year, but lack of resources meant that only 175 of those were repaired. By October this year, there was a significant increase in the number of leaks found, up to 438. But again, only 175 of those were fixed, so they're not fixing even half the leaks they find. If you look at Limerick, last year the county council there told Irish Water that its water supply was barely adequate and it did not have enough staff to find all of the leaks. But at the same time, it managed to fix more than 1,000 leaks. This year, Limerick City and Council have been combined into one area. By the end of October, the new expanded body had found just 163 leaks and repaired only 112 of those.
That's a huge fall, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. And there's all other big falls in other counties. You have Mayo, where there are 886 leaks repaired last year. In the first 10 months of this year, 764 were found, but only 386 repaired. In Donegal, you had over 1,178 leaks last year. In the first 10 months of this year, it found just 420 and repaired only 318.
So what does Irish Water have to say about all of this?
Well, it points out that it's not the number of leaks that's the most important thing. It's the amount of water lost.
Right, some leaks are more equal than others.
Exactly, not all leaks are equal. So it gives an example. It says that in one situation it found leaks at 80 properties that between them were using 1 million litres of water per day, where you'd expect that number of properties to use around 30,000 litres. So fixing leaks like that saves a massive amount of water. And another thing that it claimed is that in some cases, what the company is doing is instead of going back to the same leaking section of pipe again and again and patching up leaks, it's repairing the whole length of pipe. So in that case, you'd have just one repair recorded. But obviously, you'd have a much better outcome because you'd save a lot more water. So they're saying that also could be a factor. But the test of all this, I suppose, is has Irish Water reduced the amount of water being lost through the whole system through leaks? Last year when they took over, at the beginning of this year, they estimated that around 40% of the water supply was being lost through leaks. They can't say at the moment what the comparison is now, whether that's what percentage of water is being lost now through leaks. So we don't know if that has improved. One thing, though, that they do say is that their estimate of how much water was being lost when they took over has increased as they're finding more things going on, and they're saying that now at the time they believed it was around 40%, now they're saying that they believe it was probably up to around 48-50%.
So it's even worse than we or they thought. Coleman, yes. Thank you very much indeed for that. That was Coleman.
Hidden waiting lists, that was the headline in yesterday's Sunday Business Post. The papers say tens of thousands of people are waiting for tests to detect cancer and heart disease, often over a year, but are not being included in published waiting lists. The Minister for Health says waiting times are unacceptable, but there is no attempt to conceal the information. We'll talk to the HSE later. Professor Trevor Duffy is a consultant rheumatologist at Connolly Hospital in Blanchardstown and the Hermitage Clinic. He's also president of the Irish Medical Organisation. That's the largest representative body for doctors in the country. Professor Duffy, thank you very much for coming in to us.
Thank you.
Hidden waiting lists, you've read the story, you've seen the numbers. Are these patients being included on published waiting lists or not?
No. In general, patients waiting for diagnostic tests have probably passed step one. The bulk of them have passed step one of the published waiting list. That's the waiting time to see a consultant to get their first appointment. And that's our concern, I suppose, as consultants within the IMO, really. This is something that's not new to us. It's something we've been trying to highlight for a long time, that the focus on simply on waiting lists at the moment has taken away kind of the reason for us trying to understand these statistics, and that's patient care. And we've really been highlighting for a long time that if you consider a first patient appointment, you also have to ensure that you have the services behind it to deal with those patients.
Just to stay with the list for the moment, because there are two lists that are published. One is the length of time it takes to get your first appointment.
Yes.
Usually at an outpatient department with a consultant or a member of his team. And then the waiting time for how long it takes to get your procedure done. Now, do diagnostic tests come under those procedures? Is that part of the second waiting list?
No. In general, simplistically, I'd have to say no. In general, procedural waiting lists are for patients who might need an intervention. Largely, it's a curative intervention.
Like an operation?
Yeah, say a gallbladder removed. Now, on small occasions, some of those procedures might have a diagnostic component, but really what we mean is the patient who attends, say, a neurologist with a headache that causes them great concern and it needs to be sorted out, that patient will then need an MRI scan typically, and that appears on no waiting lists. So a patient waiting to see a neurologist could wait 6 months, could wait longer, and then they get to see the neurologist, they build up all their anxieties for that day, and then they leave with a card to book an MRI scan, and that could take them another 6 months.
According to the Sunday Business Post, around 27,000, and these are based on figures that were given to Billy Kelleher, the Fianna Fáil Health spokesperson, in a Dáil question. Why, in your view, are these lists so long?
I think it's multifactorial, but I hate to say it, but it does come down to resource in a significant component, really. And it's both capital resource in terms of machines and facilities to perform the scans, but also enough manpower resource to report them. If you think an MRI scan is an incredibly complex scan, it takes thousands of images of whatever part of the body. It needs skilled people to operate the machine and skilled people to interpret it. And in the private sector, we often compare performance across the two. In the private sector, you'll have these scans, these machines running 18 hours a day quite often. In the public sector, we're constrained because of the availability of staff to run these machines.
When a GP wants a patient, in his view or her view, to have, for example, an MRI scan, what do they do to get your attention?
Well, again, the standard route is they will write a letter of referral to the consultant in question for their outpatient clinic. I would hope to think that if the GP feels it's of any urgency or concern, that they pick up the phone. Now, that's easier said than done. I mean, anybody who's tried to ring a relative in a hospital at the moment will know the difficulty of getting through switchboards. But I would hope to think that lines of communication for urgent patients are fairly open. And we do tend to try and put urgent people to the top of a list.
If they want, and when I say you, I'm just using because you're in front of me. If they want you to see them privately, how do they get hold of you?
Again, generally they write a letter. I mean, it's actually probably simpler privately, because they write a letter and the waiting time is shorter. They don't feel the need to pick up the phone.
Why is it shorter?
It's because I think in large measure things like machines, facilities run so much more. Instead of a machine producing X product at the end of the week, it produces 2X. If a machine runs 8 hours a day or runs 16 hours a day, you can see
but in many cases the same machines and the same people operating them are being used on public and private patients. So again, why is it easier for a private patient to get access to them quicker?
No,
often in a public hospital
it wouldn't be the same people. I mean part of the significant block in managing things like MRI or ultrasound waiting lists is skilled technicians, so radiographers, ultrasonographers, and they're entirely different staffing lists who run them.
If the HSC say they're undergoing a validation process, a full review of diagnostic waiting times to ensure that urgent patients are seen as a priority. We'll ask them what that means later. What do you think it means? What's a validation process?
Well, I think when systems become as complex as this, quite often people will end up on one or two waiting lists. Sometimes patients will end up on a public waiting list, and because they've become concerned or anxious about the length of time they've been waiting, they will have had a scan privately. So it's to try and kind of ensure that the people who are on the waiting list at the moment still need the scan, so that you can better plan the time. That would be my understanding of it. And when it's done in a considered fashion, that's how it should be done.
Trevor Duffy, Professor Trevor Duffy, thank you very much for coming into our studio. We'll speak to a representative of
it. Month, two elderly sisters were rushed to hospital in Cork City suffering from carbon monoxide poisoning. Noreen, who's 82, and 92-year-old Eileen Nocton were discovered when a neighbour became concerned. Following the incident, a company which makes carbon monoxide alarms contacted the Gardaí and said they would like to do something for the community. Superintendent Con Cadogan of Grona Brohair Garda Station is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
What's due to happen today?
Well, it's a community safety project involving sponsored provision of carbon monoxide and smoke detectors for the elderly and the vulnerable residents in the Blarney Street and surrounding areas.
So how many alarms do you have? Who gave them to you and who's going to be installing them?
We have identified approximately 300 residents in the area who are obviously in need of these alarms. And Apex Fire and EI Electronics have come on board. We believe that they're providing somewhere in about one third of those. And we're obviously hoping that more may be provided. Also, I suppose the Community Association, in conjunction with Age Action Ireland and Community Policing Unit here in Gronabrogher, are actually starting this morning installing some of those alarms for the most needy in the area.
So there'll be a lot of work going on today?
There will be, and certainly over the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Will you tell us a little about the Nocton sisters? How are they now?
Well, both are still in hospital. Thankfully, they're going to make a full recovery. They're very fortunate, I suppose, to be alive. They owe their life to their neighbours, actually. And how this came about was that their neighbours noticed on the Saturday morning, the 29th of November, that they weren't out at 9 a.m. as they normally would be. Became concerned, called the local station here in Gronabrogher. Gardaí immediately went to the scene and forced entry into the house, where on entering the house, they discovered both sisters unconscious in the sitting room. We believe they had been there since the evening before.
And they had had, what, a stove or a fire or something like that on?
It was a stove, yes. And obviously, the Gardaí were overcome by fumes as well at that stage and discovered it was carbon monoxide, actually. Which is the silent killer, of course, as you're aware.
There's a lot to be said for vigilant neighbours, isn't there?
Absolutely, and I suppose I'd appeal, especially at this time of year, you know, to encourage people to visit your elderly and vulnerable neighbours, you know, because it's very important if you only just pop in to say hello and let your neighbours know that you're around. Certainly, this is epitomised by what happened with the Nocton sisters. They're alive today because of good neighbours. You don't have to be over-invasive or over-intrusive with your neighbours. It could be down to exchanging phone numbers and just letting your neighbour know that you're available. You know, there are many supports out there, both voluntary and statutory, which can be tapped into. And it's about, I suppose, pushing that button when it's needed to launch those supports. And, you know, unfortunately, all too often, I suppose, it's after the fact when something tragically has happened that a lot of those kick in. But by being the good neighbour, obviously, you can kick that in time.
Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for joining us and the very best of luck with the work. That was Superintendent Con Cadogan there of Gronabrogher Garda Station in Cork. It's Pádraig Lodge is here with Sports News. Good morning, Pádraig.
Hi, Rachel. Good morning to you. Well, Rory McIlroy was named as the RTE Sports Person of the Year at last night's ceremony in the RTE Television Centre. McIlroy won two majors, the British Open and the US PGA Championship, and was also part of the victorious Europe Ryder Cup team. The Ireland Rugby head coach Joe Schmidt was named Manager of the Year, having led Ireland to third in the world rankings with victory in the Six Nations Championship and in all three November internationals, while after a public vote, the Team of the Year award went to the Cork ladies football team, who won their ninth All-Ireland title in 10 years with victory over Dublin. Brian O'Driscoll was inducted into the Hall of Fame. His parents Geraldine and Frank were on hand to make the presentation, and O'Driscoll admitted that he knew nothing about receiving the award in advance.
I was listening to the names of previous recipients, and I was hearing Carl Mullen and Jack Kyle and Willie John McBride, and I was like, oh yeah, who's that now? I was looking around, and I hear 1-4-1 test matches, like, heart nearly jumped out of my chest. So yeah, a lovely surprise.
And a surprise for everyone, because it's one of these situations, you know what it's like in a workplace, that you get a whisper what's going to happen over the course of the week, but you were completely in the dark, and to have your mum and dad here must be phenomenal.
Literally not a clue. Now my wife had no idea either. I sat down and kind of had looked at my phone. I saw a text message from her asking, would it be outrageous to get a bag of chips on the way home? And then I got another one a couple of minutes later, and she'd realised what was going on.
Just in terms of the career, because you've obviously had a bit of time to reflect upon it now, and for a lot of people, you exploded onto the scene in Paris. For some of us who are from a certain part of Dublin, you were the doctor's son who had a cap for Ireland and then went on to do great things. Could you ever conceive the journey or the life that rugby would have given you?
No, of course not. I think you know, I was always a big believer in living in the moment, and I never really kind of looking back or looking too far ahead. So, you know, when you look back on it now and you're given a bit of time to reflect it, you know, I feel absolutely blessed to have been able to do it for as long as I did. And, you know, to be able to call going out on my own terms was also a lovely thing to be able to do.
Just to finish, because we've annoyed you so much about standout games and everything else, what's been the most challenging aspect of the last 7 months since you hung up your boots? What's been the biggest readjustment?
It's funny because, you know, I really craved having my own diary and not having to adhere to the team diary. But now I miss the structure in my life, you know, that they give me. So, that, you know, the grass is always greener. So just getting back, you know, maybe it wasn't so bad being told where I had to be, meetings at particular times, what I had to wear. Maybe that wasn't so bad after all.
Brian O'Driscoll with Damon O'Mara. Nice that it's still possible to keep a secret in this multimedia age. Slovakian Martin Skrtel, he had headed a goal deep in stoppage time to secure a 2-2 draw for Liverpool at home to Arsenal in the English Premier League. Philippe Coutinho put the hosts in front, but the Gunners turned things around with goals from French duo Mathieu Debuchy and Olivier Giroud. Skrtel thundered in a late header from Stephen Gerrard's corner to ensure the team's finished level. Arsenal moved back into sixth bottom goal difference above Tottenham. The leaders Chelsea can restore their 3-point advantage over Manchester City with a win away to Stoke City tonight. The Arsenal manager Arsene Wenger was disappointed to let the win slip so late in the game.
Liverpool didn't give up, and I felt that we couldn't score a third goal, you know, and maybe be too passive, wanted too much to keep the result, and at the end of the day we made a big mistake on the 2-2 because we didn't even jump for the corner. It's unexplainable, but it happened.
Adam Johnson's late goal gave Sunderland a 1-0 win over Newcastle at St James's Park. In the Scottish Premiership, Celtic lost 2-1 at Dundee United, while Ali McCoist has left his position as Rangers manager. The Scottish Championship clubs say he's now on gardening leave. He handed in his resignation earlier this month and had started his 12-month notice period. Rangers are 9 points behind the Championship leaders Hearts. The Tipperary County football final was played in Cashel yesterday and it finished in a draw. Care 1-10, Lochmore Castellini 2-7. The replay has been fixed for St Stephen's Day, again in Cashel with a 1 o'clock throw-in. After being just one shot off the lead after the third round of the Dubai Open, Darren Clark had to settle for a share of 15th position. The former British Open champion posted a level par 72 in the final round to end on 9-under. That was 7 shots adrift of the winner, Arjun Atwal from India. Willie Mullins teamed up with his son Patrick to win 2 races at Thurles yesterday. Lyrical Theatre landed the Mayor's Maiden Hurdle and Pile on the Pressure was a runaway winner of the bumper. And in show jumping, Wexford's Bertram Allen riding Molly Malone placed 7th in the 13-man jump-off at the World Cup qualifier at Olympia in London. Allen looked to be on course for victory until he had the penultimate fence down, although he did have the fastest time of the competition. The winner was Marco Kuscher from Germany.
The number of Irish graduates getting jobs abroad is growing. Just over half of graduates have a job within a year, but a quarter of them are working out of Ireland. The information is based on surveys from 7 universities here and 6 teacher training colleges carried out by the Higher Education Authority. Their chief executive, Tom Boland, is here. Tom, thanks for coming into us.
Good morning, Gavin.
Lots of talk of brain drain in this morning's newspapers as a result of this survey. Is Ireland experiencing a brain drain in your view?
I wouldn't be at all as negative as that. I'm well aware of what the phrase means. But just bear in mind the overall context here is of a situation where employment of graduates generally has now come back to pre-recession levels. Those seeking employment are something around the order of 6%, and the general unemployment rate is between 10 and 11%. So that's very positive. We're also seeing salaries finally, the decline in salaries finally being reversed, the salaries for graduates, the decline which has been going on for years. So even here in Ireland, the salaries for graduates is increasing. And the third very important piece here in this, apart from the brain drain issue, is that graduates in ICT programmes are hugely in demand and are showing very, very high employment levels, both here and abroad, proving the point that, in fact, that much often repeated need for ICT graduates is, in fact, a reality. So, come back to the brain drain, then, yes. then if I may. I think what it shows, Gavin, is that it's absolutely essential that we focus as a country on economic recovery, because there is no question about it. Nobody should be forced to immigrate to get employment. So I think that's the bottom line. And clearly, there is still some element of that. Even though economic recovery is taking hold, these trends take time to feed through. On the other hand, I'm not at all as negative as brain drain as that phrase would imply. There are positives here as well. One positive is it is quite clear that our higher education system is still graduating graduates of very high quality, which are highly in demand internationally. And that in the context of the severe reduction in resources to the universities over the last few years, the quality is still being maintained. And the other point to remember, I think, previous history would show us that when economic recovery does occur, and there are very strong signs of that now, many of those people, not all, but many of those people will return to Ireland and bring the additional skills that they've gained abroad with them. And also, I suppose it's important to say, not everybody is immigrating because they have to. Many people do so because it is the right thing to do in terms of career. So it's a bit of a curate's egg in that regard.
What graduates are most likely to leave?
It's right across the board, actually. The graduates who have least success, let's say, in achieving employment and achieving high pay employment, are those in the humanities and social the arts and humanities faculties. They are the ones that have least success generally.
And teachers, because you surveyed 6 teacher training colleges.
A significant number of education graduates are also immigrating, and that combined with the fact that also a very significant number of graduates in teaching in while they are in employment. They actually are in temporary employment. And that, I think, reflects the current structure of the teaching profession here in Ireland. The teachers are getting employment, but a significant number of them are, for a period of time, in temporary employment.
Female graduates are more likely to have found a job within 9 months, but compared to males, on lower salaries still. Why?
This is just, again, so consistent right across society. And we recently, just a week or so, had an issue around the proportion of females in the upper echelons of the academic career. It's societal, it's culture, it requires an enormous amount of input to address that. But it isn't just in academia, it's right across society.
Of those
who I have no answer for them, Gavin.
Of those who aren't working, what are they doing?
A significant proportion go back to continue their education.
Okay.
And that's a very, very important choice for them to make, because all this, our statistics also show that, in fact, with a higher qualification, the chances of getting a job are higher still. And a small number, I think it's of the order of 3%, are just not available for work. They have decided to take a year out or whatever.
Okay, Tom Boland from the Higher Education Authority, thank you very much for coming into our studio. It's 7:45.
A survey carried out by the Money Advice and Budgeting Service, MABS, has shown that many shops are continuing to charge a top-up fee to people using pay-as-you-go energy meters. 3 surveys carried out in 2 Dublin suburbs indicate that the number of shops levying a charge has actually increased. Michael Cullity of MABS is here. Michael, not everybody will be familiar with this pay-as-you-go system. How does it work?
Well, Rachel, really, it is for people who can't afford to pay, I suppose, full bills on time. And particularly in the energy sector, it's people who got these pay-as-you-go meters put in because they were threatened with a disconnection and they find paying monthly or bi-monthly bills very difficult. So they pay when they can, basically, and they top up their meter by going to a store and buying a top-up, just like you top up your mobile phone, for example.
So it's not just electricity we're talking about here. You can pay the gas this way or other bills as well.
Or other bills this way as well, yes.
How many shops did you look at and where?
Well, really, there was one area where our MAB service, took a particular interest in this, mainly because of the demographics of the area, of the high unemployment and of the fuel poverty in the area. And that was in the Ballyfermot, Cherry Orchard, Palmerstown and Chapelizod area. And they found that last May was their first kind of mystery shopping, and they found that out of 15 shops, 9 were charging a surcharge. Went back on the 14th of December to visit the same stores, thinking that the publicity that we would have given it last time round would have brought about a seismic change, but of course it didn't, because the situation got worse. And by this month, 12 shops are now charging, with only 3 not charging in that area. And also what we noticed, amazingly enough, is that where there was plenty of signs notifying customers in May, a lot of those signs had been removed in December, showing that there is sensitivity around the traders, around charging a surcharge to their customers for a very basic need, basically.
On average, how much extra do they charge?
Well, it varies. The highest charge, believe it or not, was in County Mayo, where a customer was charged €1 to top up a 10 euro top up, which is crazy. But in the Greater Dublin area, it varies between 20 cent and 50 cent on top of for a top up. The other thing to remember is that a lot of these consumers are already paying a portion of their top up to arrears. They can be paying 25 to 30% on top of any usage.
Oh, okay. So if they're putting €10 onto the card, say maybe
a third of that
is actually going elsewhere. It's
absolutely
not, it's not going towards providing heat or light in the here and now.
Absolutely.
Lots of cards, though, lots of pay-as-you-go type cards slap on some sort of surcharge. So why should this one be any different?
Well, I think that, look, if we're talking about basic services here, and we would feel that basic services should not have a surcharge on them. Really, the service should be free to the consumer, and we don't know. This only happened about a year ago. Before that, there were no surcharges for these. So you wonder what the rationale is, because the shopkeepers are being paid by Payzone, for example, who are in turn being paid by the energy companies to provide this service. And also, I know from one of the from Payzone's own research shows that over 60% of the footfall created by this service, they buy extra in the store.
People are also getting the pint of milk, the loaf of bread, the newspaper,
so
or whatever.
You wonder why they're treating their customers so badly by putting a surcharge on top of them. And the other worrying thing is that very often the multiples are the leaders in this by charging extra to customers. And really, you would have hoped that they would provide the leadership in this regard.
Is there anything you can do?
Gosh, I suppose we're shouting loud. Hopefully.
You shouted loud the last time, though,
and
as you were saying yourself,
the situation
only got worse.
Yeah, well, we hope that people will get together now, that everybody who's involved in this and will, stop having the poor pay more for something that's very basic, because in our experience, people are going without heat and light who have these prepayment meters.
Michael Cullity of the Money Advice and Budgeting Service, thank you very much for joining us.
Rachel, Employers Group IBEC says that despite disappointing preliminary growth figures for the third 3 months of the year, the Irish economy will outperform the rest of Europe and grow by 5.7% this year. In its latest quarterly economic outlook, IBEC says the recovery finally reached the domestic economy, with unemployment falling, investment increasing, and the Irish consumer looking ahead with more confidence. We've just heard about energy costs from MAB's Michael Cullity, while IBEC says lower oil prices will add extra momentum to the consumer recovery, with every $10 fall in the price of a barrel of oil translating into an additional €100 million spending power for Irish consumers. We're joined in studio now by IBEC's chief economist Fergal O'Brien. Fergal, can you spell out how a $10 fall in the price of oil means so much more spending power?
Yeah, good morning, Emma. How are you? It's a very significant stimulus for the Irish economy to see this reduction in imported energy costs. Clearly, falling oil prices are a symptom of challenges in the emerging global economy in particular. But for Ireland and Irish consumers, and about €3.5 billion that we're spending on fuel costs, when we look at the historical data, it matches at current price levels to about €100 million. Stimulus for the Irish consumer in terms of spending power boost for the reduction that we're now seeing for every $10 in oil. So we've already seen a significant fall in terms of petrol price at the pumps, and although tax accounts for 60% of that price, we still see quite a significant pass-through. Consumers are benefiting at the moment, motor fuel, home heating oil, and it really is quite a significant stimulus.
Before we came on air, you were talking to Michael Cullity, who we've just heard on air. Will that increased spending power be felt by everyone in society?
We are seeing it. I think spill across different sectors of the economy now. What started very much as an export recovery has become an investment recovery. We're seeing construction workers in very significant numbers back at work as construction activity picks up. Consumers are now eventually beginning to come out. So our retail sales have been very strong this year. It surprised us somewhat that we haven't seen the same increase in spending on services, but spending in the shops has been good. So it is spilling out across the economy, and we're beginning to feel it outside of Dublin as well, because it has very much to date been a Dublin-centred recovery in the main urban cities. We're beginning to see an improvement now in terms of that regional spread of the recovery.
Construction workers, you mentioned unemployment to fall below 9% by the end of next year. How will that be achieved?
I suppose the most spectacular feature of the recovery to date is that the jobs have come early in this recovery. So we were talking about employment recovery 18 months ago. 2014 has been the full first year of significant GDP recovery, but the jobs have continued to come. And I suppose the most striking feature of the employment recovery this year is that it's been a conversion to full-time employment. We're going to continue to see jobs growth next year in excess of about 2%. We're getting below single digits. We could touch 9 or below 9% by the end of next year. So the employment recovery now is quite solid, and crucially as well, a good spread. We have 14 sectors in employment. 10 of them are now adding significant new jobs. So again, becoming much more broad-based in terms of the recovery, Emma.
Exports, we often hear how successful a part of the economy are, but the sector can be confusing. Can you spell out how these exports are measured?
It can sometimes be, I think, tricky if you're looking from the outside at the Irish economy and trying to forecast GDP. Can definitely be a tricky occupation. Our exports at the moment are growing exceptionally strongly. We're going to have double-digit growth this year. There is a phenomenon in there called contract manufacturing, which is impacting on some of the exports numbers we're seeing. But aside from that, we're still seeing very broad-based export recovery in both the modern, what we regard as a modern high-tech sector, where we're more likely to this phenomenon of contract manufacturing, where the manufacturing is actually happening outside of Ireland, but it is counted as an Irish export. But we're also seeing a very strong improvement in exports in our traditional sectors. So food and drink, other parts of manufacturing, engineering, they're all performing very strongly. So it's not just the high-tech exports that are driving this. In terms of the overall impact back on GDP, on a net basis, it's likely to be minimal over the long time, because it's netted out with imports and royalty payments, and ultimately with profit repatriation, where that's happening in the multinational sector.
5.7% growth you forecast for this year. How about next year? Will it be as strong?
I think we're looking at in the region. We've felt for some time in IBEC that the trend growth rate in the Irish economy is between 3 and 4%. This time last year, government built its estimates of the economy on a 2% growth rate. This year has been exceptional. I think next year we'll see something between 4 and 5. So we're on a pretty good trend growth at the moment. We're going through some catch-up as we exit this recession. And I think next year we're going to see another very solid performance.
Okay, IBEX Fergal O'Brien, thanks very much for joining us in studio this morning. Briefly to the currencies, the euro is trading at $1.22.56 and it's 78 pence sterling.
Another breezy day. The strong southwest winds are going to continue through today. Fresh to strong and gusty. And there's outbreaks of rain, and the rain is heavy over Ulster and Connacht. It'll extend eastwards and southwards down to Leinster, probably Westminster, but it's going to stay largely dry across southern coastal counties today. Temperatures still around 10 to 12 degrees. They haven't changed much, and they're not going to change much either, not for the next day or two. Temperatures over Ulster tonight might drop a degree or two, down to about 7 to 9 degrees, because the cold front is going to clear southwards just a little, but it'll push back up again. Clearance for a time and winds will ease, but other than that, not changing much overnight tonight. Tomorrow, Tuesday, it's still going to be mild. Still the temperature's up around 10 or 12 degrees and still raining too. The rain will be heavy over the north for a time. It's going to very slowly clear east southwards as tomorrow evening progresses. So it'll be right through tomorrow before the rain starts to come all the way south. So the last of the rain then clearing southeast on Tuesday night and into Wednesday, and then Wednesday's Christmas Eve. That's going to be a mostly dry day. It'll still be mild just for a time. The temperatures in the south coast 10 or 11 degrees, but elsewhere it's going to get significantly colder. About 5 to 8 degrees we're going to get into a northwesterly flow, and it's going to be a much colder day. So Christmas Eve and into Christmas night, then our Ian Ullock Christmas Eve night, getting cold and frosty. So we wake up to a nice frosty, fresh, crisp day on Christmas Day. A nice cold, frosty day, as it should be on Christmas Day. Temperatures during the day on Christmas Day, about 4 to 7 degrees. And going to get very, very cold then on Christmas night with clear skies, temperatures down about -4 degrees. No point in going further than that. We haven't got a clear picture beyond St. Stephen's Day. A bit of rain on St. Stephen's Day. Beyond that, the atmosphere is way too uncertain and we've no further outlook than that. But in the meantime, mild and rainy. Good morning.